Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday?
I've had this for a mission.
I'm worried.
Okay, if we could get started, please.
I think it's really fruitful, as in the other classes, maybe to go around and talk about what people hope to get out of this and they find out who likes to sing. Maybe we can have people here singing as the week progresses too. I want us to hear as much as we can possibly hear from Gene Ritchie and from Lovis Dickey. And you never know who else might happen along this week, but Jerry Milnes is a great singer of West Virginia ballads. I'd like to hear from Louis Kellen in this class. To think about the antecedents of some of the old ballads, if you know English or British folk versions of some of these Appalachian ballads, it would be fun to hear those sung back and forth. So we've got a lot of resources here this week, but I'm just wanting to get an idea of who's here and what they want to get out of it. Could we start with you?
I'd just like to be here. It's sort of an introduction to...
What is your name?
George Norman.
Okay.
Sort of an introduction to hear what some of these ballads sound like and, what kind of stories that relate, some different themes involved in.
Are you a singer yourself, George?
No, actually I'm not a singer. I'm an instrumentalist. I play the band. Really enjoyed listening to ballads, just to say.
Yeah, me too. Okay.
My name is Maura Nelligan, and I'm from Athens, Georgia. I grew up in Savannah, Georgia. And there's no music in Savannah, Georgia, so I had to move. No, I'm just kidding. I'm exaggerating. But in Athens, there are people in Athens, Georgia, there are people that sing and play, mostly old time. And I've just started, I played instruments for a while, but I've just started learning songs recently, the past couple of months, so this is pretty new to me. And so I was just, I just want to collect some songs.
Great.
And hear good singing.
Well, the idea maybe of singing them yourself.
Oh, yeah, I want to sing.
Good. Okay.
I'm Meredith McIntosh from Asheville, North Carolina. And this music, in all ways, is pretty new to me. I'm just starting on fiddle. Enjoy dancing, and I do enjoy singing, though my shyness outbalances that a lot of times. I'm interested.
You sing in the shower a lot, do you?
I've set it up so I live at home, so my dog gets to hear me. That's good. And so I'm confronting myself in that way here, as well as to hear some good singing and learn some tunes.
I'm glad you're here.
Okay, I'm Mark Steiner, first time in Augusta. I'm a folklorist. Balladry is my specialty. I'm also a singer, too. And so I'm here. There's always stuff I can learn and maybe something I can contribute to. And I'm just glad to be here.
Okay, Mark.
I'm Carl Ekstrom. I currently live in Rochester. Seemed like the best thing at this hour, so that's why I'm here.
All right. We're glad that we offered such an inspired program. Yeah.
My name is Sally. I love to sing, but I don't feel like I know how to sing very well. But I want to learn, so that's what I'm doing this class. Learn some songs.
Do you like old songs?
Yeah.
And such a young girl too. And you're so young, too, I said.
I play banjo, so it'd be good. It'd be fun to know how to sing.
Are you in the
That's where everybody's learning how to sing.
Okay. It's all right, dancing's good for you too.
Louis?
I'm Louis Killen. I have a class that follows this one. I thought I'd better come to this one so I get some idea of my own class.
Uh-huh. An honest man.
Okay. Can you tell people where your music comes from?
It's pretty general, in the sense that it comes from Britain, obviously. Majority of my material comes from England, some from Scotland, and some from Ireland. I'm sort of mixed background as far as parents, Irish. I learned one song from them. I'm not going to tell you that I learned all these songs that my parents used, because I didn't. I said I learned one song from my brother. One from traditional song, that is, and a few from my father, maybe sort of local dialect songs they like to sing. So we all like to sing in our family, and we pick the material from anywhere. And folk songs were not just a general part of my family background. I sort of went from that, and in personal interest in folk music, into picking up other songs. From the rest of the country. It's the desire, the curiosity to know what the background is. I like history. I love the story songs because they basically are history from the bottom up. And that's what I sing mainly is story songs.
What do you do when you're not listening to songs?
What do I do?
What do you do with the rest of your time?
Mostly I like to dance.
Yeah. Dancer, okay. We're glad you're here. Yeah.
I'm Sharon Ewer from Tacoma Park. Formerly from Tacoma. Anyway,
I hope you'll chime in with some of the scholarly, some of the scholarly connections that you can make on this.
If I can make some
time. My name is Michael Klein, and I have an interest in ballads that's related to singing rather than scholarship. And I'm interested in singing these ballads. I sing them a lot in local schools too, because I think it's important to reawaken in children a sense of their own connections to life around them. I'm interested in the living ballad tradition here in West Virginia. In many parts of the country, it's a thing of the past. Here, it's a living tradition. There are people still doing it. I spent Saturday afternoon at the home of Sherman and Maggie Hammonds and heard Maggie sing some more ballads I'd never heard before, and had a wonderful time with them. I sing these songs to my children. I've integrated them into my own family life. I'm interested in the role that these old ballads can play helping to reshape self-esteem in West Virginia, which I feel has been largely lost. We're talking about a place in which 80% of the natural wealth is owned by people who don't live here, and that tells you a lot about self-esteem, or the lack of it. And so I'm interested in how songs and stories can help reshape that. I've spent a lot of time out in communities with old singers, recording them, and learning a lot of these songs at their feet. Even though I may have the ballad on tape, I like to go back and back and back until I can learn it directly, because there's so much about learning to sing besides hitting the right notes. There's the whole attitude, the whole use of the body, you know, everything about the way a person sings interests me. So I like to go back and back and back and see people. And I wanted to ask Jean if she could talk a little bit maybe about Old Christmas, because that just happened last week. I know that you know at least one old carol that came down through your family related to Old Christmas, but I wondered what else you could remember about it from your childhood in Kentucky, if it was still celebrated or if it was still recollected by people.
It's still recollected. My Granny Kathy was the last one to really celebrate it. She died at the age of about 96, maybe 30 years ago. So that's her age, her time. But I say, Mike, she died about 30 years ago, and she was 96 then. So that's sort of the maybe 25 years ago. I don't know. Time has no meaning for me. It sort of goes too fast all the time anyway. But Granny Caddy, her name was, I guess, Kate, or no, her name was Rachel. But when she was a little baby in a cradle, her daddy, Solomon Everidge, looked down at her and said, "Look at her coiled up like a little cat." And so Cat was her name from then on. She was Catty. So she's known as Granny Catty even when she was 95 years old. But she used to sit in front of the fire on January 5th, her old Christmas Eve. And she would just sit there and hum and sing and tell us about old Christmas. She said, "Now, Christmas is supposed to be a holy time. It's not all this jumping around and giving presents and trying to see how much you can get. If you're a baby and you're a little girl, you know, you don't think about giving, you think about getting." And she used to give us all these lectures about how Christmas had lost its meaning and so on. But she said, "You're just supposed to think holy thoughts and remember the birthday of the King." So she'd sit in front of the fireplace and do that. She'd tell us that if we waited up until midnight, we'd go out to the barn and look in through the cracks. We'd see the old mule and cow and all the animals kneeling down, and that the elderberry bushes and all the forsythia, whatever was in the yard, would be blooming, would burst into blossom at midnight. All these things, and we were just a sure believer. Yeah, none of us could ever stay awake that long. So we never checked it out, but I still believe it, that if she believed it, it must be true. Her Christmas song was, I've come to learn since then, was an Epiphany song. It's Brightest and Best of the Sons of Morning. And she would just sing that, and we'd all kind of join in with her. I'll sing it for you. Hail the blessed. last morn when the great mediator down from the regions of glory descend. Shepherds go worship the babe in the manger. Lo, for a guard the bright angels attend. Brightest and best of the sons of the morning, dawn on our darkness and lend us thine aid. Star in the east, the horizon adorning. Guide where our infant Redeemer is laid. Well, that's a common enough song in the church books now. It's got other verses to it too. It's not a ballad especially, but that was her Christmas song. You wanted to know about that. Another one that Uncle Jason sang, and I suppose Granny knew it too, was the Cherry Tree Carol, which is not particularly an old Christmas song, but yeah, it is too. It has the verses in the end, but yeah. I'll just do a verse or two of that. When Joseph were an old man, and an old man were he courted the Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. He courted the Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. Joseph and Mary out walking one day. Here is apples, here is cherries, so fair to behold. Here is apples, here is cherries, so fair to behold. Mary spoke to Joseph, and to Joseph said she, go and gather me some cherries, for I am with child. Go and gather me some cherries, for I am with child. Joseph flew in angry, and in angry flew he. Said, let the father of the baby gather cherries for thee. Said, let the father of the baby gather cherries for thee. Then up spoke Lord Jesus from his mother's womb, said, bow low, low cherry tree, bow ye low down to the ground, said, bow low, low cherry tree, bow ye low down to the ground. Then the cherry tree bowed low down to the ground. And Mary, she gathered cherries while Joseph stood around. And Mary, she gathered cherries while Joseph stood around. Then Joseph took Mary all on his left knee. Oh, tell me, little baby, day will be. Oh, tell me, little baby, when your birthday will be. On the sixth day of January, my birthday will be, when the stars and the elements shall tremble with glee. When the stars and the elements shall tremble with glee.
I don't know near as much about this old Christmas question as I'd like to know. I do know that after the Julian calendar was adopted, that the Julian calendar lost about a day a century. Such that it was noticeably out of sync by the 16th century, and Pope Gregory made some changes in the calendar, and a new calendar was adopted, I think, in the year 1588, but it was in the late 16th century, which ironed out the deficiencies of the older system and jumped 10 days. So suddenly, I think it was in October of that year, they just dropped 10 days from the calendars. Well, they had people in the streets, you know, ready to revolt. Everybody was furious.
It was a long feud, and the fact that Granny still celebrates, she still believed that they shouldn't have messed with the calendar, you know. So,
well, absolutely. Well, she was joined in this opinion by Henry VIII, who was having a terrible feud on other matters with Pope Gregory,
and
never would adopt the calendar in England, you see. So England stayed on the old system until the 18th century, when George III finally adopted the calendar. Well, by that time, your people had already boated over,
right,
and were already in the mountains.
Well, that explains why she's still celebrating Christmas.
They hung to that old, and George III had the same. But you see, by that time, by the 18th century, there had been another 2 days of slippage, and so that put the old Christmas. Had pushed it back then to January 6th.
Well, there's something interesting about that ballad too that I read in some scholarly book, was that now there was a verse before that I left out because I thought the song was getting long enough as it was, but he takes her first on his right knee and he says, "Tell me, Lord, have mercy on me. What have I done?" You know, she forgives him. And then he takes her on his left knee and says, "Tell me about the birthday." And she says, and the Christ child says, "The sixth day of January." But this book had said that the protagonists of the old Christmas had added that verse onto that song, because what you hear sung or what you read in a newspaper must be true, you know. So if they put it in a song, and it says the sixth day of January was a Christ child's birthday, well then. That won the argument, you know. So they put that in there as propaganda. So it's only as old as the fight over the calendar. not the song, but that verse, those two verses.
Do you have an old version, an old British version of that?
No, I have a version that I sing. Text is very similar to. I don't have the verse in there, but. Joseph was an old man, and an old man was he, and he courted the Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee, and he courted the Virgin Mary. The Queen of Galilee. I don't know where that's English because, well, whether it's actually from here, it's been transported back again. But that was one that had been sung around by the singers when I was called them. It wasn't one of the carols that I heard as a child.
Well, the tune that I sang is probably just a mountainized version of the straightforward tune that you hear more often than that. But people, especially the old regular Baptists and the old time singers, just had to decorate things. They couldn't, and they always liked to slow down things. They believed in taking your time when you told a story. And so it could be that way, or it could be the other way around, that the tune that everybody sings now is an ironed out version of the old tune. I don't know which.
Which is the tune that's the common one.
Yeah, it's this. If you can recognize the tune I just sang from this one, this is what I'm talking about. When Joseph were an old man, he courted Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. He courted Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. And that's what the tenor singers and so on who are singing it as a solo or something will sing that. But that is really the same tune that I was singing, except mine was more convoluted.
What else do you remember about old Christmas? Did your family have a big meal on that day?
No, we didn't celebrate. Just Granny did that, and it was her memories. And we'd sometimes, around Christmas time, around the whole winter solstice season, was a time for parties and things, and we would sometimes dress up in costume, which we had two costumes that we loved to dress up in, and that was just just to make fun, you know, to have fun at the parties around Christmas. Somebody would come in dressed like Tall Jane with a cross broomstick and thing, and so the head would be way up in the air and the arms would be out here, and then you could carry this underneath you and you'd look like a very tall person bowing and doing things and singing songs and Tall Jane. And then there was a hobby horse that you made by putting a sack over you and holding your ankles like this. And those, I think, are all we had left of the mummers' plays, you know, the characters in the mummers' plays. But we didn't do any plays or anything, but we just had those costumes, those ideas for costumes that we had dressed up in. That was the only survival we had of the hobby horse and the mummers' play.
Do you know of any other survivors?
No, not really, not around our community.
Of mummy?
Some people claim that there are, but I think they're very suspect. Richard Chase had a mummer's play, and Peter Kennedy from England was just visiting us, and he said, well, he got all that stuff from my father, Douglas Kennedy, you know, from Cecil Sheriff House. He heard the Richard Chase's mummer's play. And then there was a woman named Marie something from Kentucky, I can't remember. She's dead now, but she had a mummer's play, which she claimed was current around in Kentucky, and no one ever heard it or never saw the thing except when she put it on. So we're suspicious that people would like, well, what people do is that they would like to feel that these things were around, and so they sort of help them along. And
I was just wondering, because there's a whole folklore, I think, developing, which is the who got what from whom folklore.
Yeah.
Which is the most... people who have become folklorists or involved, like Peter, and it's like, oh, see, that was got from so and so, that was got like from my father.
Well, I mean, he just recognized the material, and he knew that Dick and his father had been friends and had that, you know, at Pinewoods all those years ago or so.
Well, I wonder how much of it was actually totally got from Douglas, or whether Richard was trying to remember things.
If Richard remembered it, why wasn't it around in other people's memories? I mean, Richard was only a collector, and he couldn't tell any people around in the community that he had collected from. I think he just wanted it to be true, and kind of helped it along a little bit. It's okay. I mean,
it then becomes like an intuition.
You just take it with you take it with a grain of salt, but. Right.
That's just the thing I was wondering about, the whole thing, the old Christmas. being put back by those who did not want the canon changed.
Yeah.
And so they made, instead of being, oh, Christmas was always the 25th of December.
Yeah.
It's just that by adding the days, it was January 6th. But the January 6th is the 12th night. It's the 12 days of Christmas.
Right.
I'm just wondering.
Well, that's another way of
saying
it.
When those songs came in, of the, you know, the 12 days of Christmas, was that after or before? Yeah. Or because they're confusing. It's an after time.
You mean before the calendar was changed, was there a 12th night also?
Yeah.
Yeah, was it January the whatever, you know?
There was certainly a week, but wasn't it 12 days? Yeah,
yeah,
it was January,
yeah.
The 12th.
But now they make it so that the 12th night comes out on January 6th, so everybody can celebrate one way or the other. So that.
But the, my wife's family are Polish, and for them it's still Christmas, January 6th.
Yeah.
Easter.
And in England, of course, I don't know, it's the same here, but the whole thing is you don't let any of your Christmas decorations hang up after the tree's got to be down. Everything's got to be down by.
Yeah, I've heard there's bad luck.
Yeah.
I used to leave mine up till Easter.
I was hilarious. My last time I was in England, my last time was in 76. I was in England and was in a house on 12th night and a quarter to midnight.
Yeah.
Suddenly realized this guy lived alone, Morris team, and those were the same folks on the club. They were all the decorations. And I was always mad. Tearing down the fire burning. And I couldn't get it down. All that dreadful bad luck was down on the house. And he was divorced within the year.
This.
But then so were a lot of others who had.
I think. It's a good idea to take your Christmas tree down before 12th night because it gets very dry and can set your house on fire.
I love old Christmas. To me, it's the height of sort of Southern Mountain honoriness. You know, people just doing things the way they want to do them and not buying into the new visions and traditions of the greater society and I've spent a lot of time with a family by the name of Hammonds that some of you may have heard me talk about or know about from the Library of Congress recordings.
Right.
And they still talk about old Christmas. Emmy Hammonds, who's now completely senile and in a world of her own, told me a couple of years ago, and it was the only coherent thing she ever said to me. I asked her one day, we were talking, and she seemed kind of alert. I said, well, what... I shouted at her as loud as I could, well, what do you remember about old Christmas? And she said, well, we'd always go out on the river and the ice and build up great big fires, and she said, and then they'd have a play. And immediately I thought of mumming. I said, here,
yeah.
This is it. This is in this
yeah.
family it survived. But then I heard him again and again use the word play as being synonymous with play party. Mm-hmm.
Because in the same Scots used the word plotting.
Yeah.
They party, a gathering, an event,
yeah.
rather than
an
actual
play. Yeah.
A play. Yeah.
And I don't think it was mumming at all. I don't think.
Yeah, that's right, mumming.
But you hear. You hear what you want to hear in this business so often. You have to be very, very careful. You have to be very, very careful because I was dying to find, you know, to find some living recollection of mumming, and
can
I of course could find.
Can you tell us what mumming is?
It is a play, often a spontaneous play, or a traditional play. In this case, symbolizing both what the elements of Christmas and the elements of the winter solstice.
Mm-hmm. The death of the old year.
The death of the old
rebirth
year,
of the
rebirth.
Usually symbolized by St. George killing the dragon, and the dragon comes back to life, things like that. So. Yeah, or they put in the Revels in Cambridge this year, we put the John Barleycorn was the hero, and he got into the circle and got in the circle of swords, you know, the sword dance, and then they cut off his head and he lies down, and the doctor comes in and cures him or tries to cure him, and then the fool finally comes along and cures him with mistletoe, and all this is all very ritualistic and old, and then he rises up and symbolizing, well, you plant barley, it grows you know, it grows, when you plant seeds, they grow up out of, and they revive and come up again. It makes new life and the fertility and all that. They all mean the same thing. They have different forms to the plays. This was supposed to be Richard Chase's play. That was the one, was Jump with Barleycorn.
Yeah. It's still put on in great length, apparently, in places like Romania and the Balkans. There's these little survivors, certainly in Britain, that it's about three specific types of plays, like a bridal play or marriage play. They all involve birth, life, death, and resurrection.
And they take place in the winter solstice season around the turn of the year.
We recorded one of the Marshfield numbers play.
Yes, in Marshfield, which is near Bath in England, Bath, as they would say. we years ago in 1952 saw a play and recorded it, and it was the old time paper boys, they called themselves. And they call themselves paper boys. Have you ever seen the paper boys?
No.
They make their costumes with newspapers, and they take a garment that hangs down to about here, and then they have trousers underneath that, and all around in rows going around the body, they sew little loops of paper. You know, a little loop of paper will go all around, and then there'll be another, it'll be overlaying another loop, and so on until they get down to the bottom. And their hats are made the same way, so they sort of rustle when they walk. Yeah.
That was probably an imitation of the straw boys.
Might be, yeah. But they said
it's about the same thing, except it's in paper.
They started out with, oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. We are the old celebrated Marshfield Mummers, better known as the old time paper boys. But it could be an imitation of the straw. And what did they kill? They killed they had a duel where somebody killed another. One person killed another, he stabs him with a sword, and then they bring him back to life. There's still, each mummer's play used to have its own song, and there are still some survivals of the mummer's song.
And your family?
Well, Nottingham Town, that's the only thing we have. That's from the Nottinghamshire, a play which has long been deceased, but the song still survives.
Can you sing that?
They were usually topsy-turvy songs, because the mummers used to disguise themselves, put on their clothes inside out or swap coats or something, because the idea was that nobody should recognize, their audience shouldn't recognize them. If you recognize them, the magic is lost. And the whole thing had to do with magic and fertility and having people have good crops next year and so on, and healthy children and so on. So they'd visit different houses and do this play in different places, all through the town. It was a magic thing. And so if you recognize the players, it was bad luck. You didn't get your magic. And the song itself also was topsy-turvy. If you knew what the song meant, you didn't get your magic. So nobody ever tried. In fair Nottingham Town, not a soul would look up. Not a soul would look up. Not a soul would look down. Not a soul would look up, not a soul would look down, to show me the way to fair Nottingham Town. I rode a gray horse that is called a gray mare, gray mane and a gray tail, green stripe down her back. Gray mane and a gray tail, a green stripe down her back. There wa'n't a hair on her be what was coal black. She stood so still, she threw me to the dirt. She tore up my hide and she bruised my shirt. From saddle to stirrup I mounted again, and on my ten toes I rode over the plain. Met the king and the queen and a company more, a riding behind and a marching before. Come a stark naked drummer, a beating a drum, with his hands in
marching along. They laughed and they smiled, not a soul did look gay. They talked all the while, not a word did they say. I bought me a quart to drive gladness away and to stifle the dust, for it rained the whole day. Sat down on a hard, hot, cold, frozen stone. 10,000 stood around me, and yet I was alone. Took my hat in my hands for to keep my head warm. 10,000 got drowned that never was born. That's a ballad. It's a ballad, isn't it? You can tell he went all through and told a whole story. But it didn't mean anything, you know. People have over the years read very profound meanings into those nonsense things. I think they were just probably originally supposed to be nonsense, but people say, oh, that's very true. You can be very alone with 10,000 around you. Well, that's true, but you know, I don't know. Other people said it came from the days of the plague when everybody was killed off. Pretty solid, though.
Is it hard to remember the words when they don't mean anything?
Well, not for me, but I've known it all my life, so. You may have recognized the tune, Bob Dylan.
All the words meaningless to you.
Huh?
All the words meaningless to you, or do you have your own set of images?
Secret meanings, yeah. Well, I can sort of see. Yeah, it has a certain feeling to me. It's a very magic, mysterious feeling, but I don't. I can't imagine a sea of people and one person being, you know, or feeling alone among people. But I never really tried to take the song apart, but that's the thing.
I was just trying to sort of catch up, as we said, because the words are, I think, you know, meaningless to people. Not to the singers.
No, they're not meaningless at all. No.
I was just trying to find out what your meanings were, that you had your own meanings.
Well, if I knew, I wouldn't tell you.
Then you wouldn't get the answer.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, when you were singing the cherry tree carol, if you visualized in your mind this uncle, was it Uncle Jason? Did you
uh-huh.
say? Do you think about him or how he sounded when you sang that? Or?
Sometimes, yeah. Uh-huh. Most all the time, I think about him because when you learn something from somebody, you the song kind of helps them live on, I think, and so. He lives on in my mind anyway. I
but in how to actually form the sound, do you see him forming that sound, or do you?
In some ways, yeah, not always. I remember how the song sounded. I remember the sound of the song. I wasn't always looking at him when he was singing. I close my eyes usually when I sing, and I think it's a an unconscious retreat by the singer. An unconscious wish not to be looked at while you're singing. And in Ireland, in some places, people got behind doors and sang for us. And sang
through. Stalls.
Yeah. And a man would sit in the corner, chimney corner, and have another person stand in front of him, and he would sit, hunker down behind him and sing the song, and the man was standing there like this, looking very nice. And the man behind him was going to get all these wonderful sounds, you know, but he didn't want anyone to see him making those sounds, so he had a front, a person standing in front of him. And I understood how they felt, because when I sing, I like to go inside myself. I mean, I'd rather just sing and not be looked at, but you can't. And when you keep your eyes open, you find yourself, if you look at people, you see their reactions or their lack of reaction and everything, and it sort of puts you off, you know, if they don't seem to be liking it. And so you have to stare up at the ceiling somewhere or over in the corner, and it's very awkward. So I just shut my eyes and shut the whole scene out and let them. And I've been criticized for it.
My friend
Jackie and Brady once said she has the words on the back of her eyelids. That's why she shuts her eyes.
That's great. That's a great line.
My friend Phyllis March is a ballad singer from Gilmer County, and she's blind, and she says it's a wonderful thing because the audience never gets interferes
yeah,
with what you're saying.
Yeah, that's the same feeling.
I'm just going to say, I can't see how you're reacting, so I'm just going to go ahead and sing this.
Isn't part of it just a focusing being? You said you just don't put it on yourself. To me, it's sort of focusing on the story. I can see the story happening, I can be there.
Yes, that's part of it.
If I'm in an audience, I'm likely to get distracted if you get the story.
But some people who are trained not to shut their eyes, I mean, the song, they have a teacher who says, oh, you mustn't do that, that's not good form. They'll get a sort of a glassy stare look in their eye. You feel sorry for them because they want to shut their eyes and they're not allowed to. Anyway.
But mumming does not seem to have survived in Southern Mountain community life. If it was ever there are not very many traces of it. You wonder why. You wonder why some things do survive and some things don't. You know, it's all.
Was mumming part of the Scots-Irish tradition?
Yes.
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 Would you explain, Mark?
Well, I know that, very, very recently there was a study that Henry Glassie published on mumming in Fermanagh. And in my own work, and this is interesting, the people in my area where I worked, rather than Christmas time, New Year's, Hogmanay, that's when people went around the country doing the plays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is Fermanagh?
Yeah.
I thought Fermanagh was more of Celtic.
Well, it is, but it's both. It's
more than Scots-Irish settlements.
Yeah, it's both. There are traces of both there. It's an interesting mix.
Well, all I'm thinking was basically that the Scots-Irish came into Ulster and then were in effect forced out again by their own